This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, a comedy satire on the U.S. war profiteering in Iraq debuted last month.
The movie is War, Inc. See how our corporations profit off war. Maybe that's what war is all about.
We'll talk with Professor Richard Falk, the recently appointed special rapporteur on human rights in the Palestinian territories.
Israel said, "Oh no, Richard, oh no, UN, you can't look at what we're doing in the occupied territories." Barred.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. Michael, you've been following the events in Guantanamo quite closely. Can you give us an update on what's happened recently?
Well, as our listeners know, the Center for Constitutional Rights has been involved with Guantanamo for many years, in fact, brought the first cases, and we still have a major part of our work concerns the representation of Guantanamo detainees, as well as coordinating around the country and around the world, really, with trying to close down Guantanamo. As I'm sure our listeners know also, that Guantanamo is really just the tip of the iceberg. That we have 270-some people left in Guantanamo who were imprisoned, but in places like Bagram in Afghanistan and Iraq and others, there's tens of thousands of people, and certainly in some of the high-security ones, there's hundreds, if not thousands, who are being punished and tortured probably in a way that we've been able to at least stop at Guantanamo by getting lawyers there and getting some court involvement. But there's been a number of updates on Guantanamo. One of the first, of course, is that part of Guantanamo, which we've talked about before, has been an attempt to try people, some of the people at Guantanamo, with what are called military commissions. That came out initially in the president's military order of November 13th, 2001. He set up what we call kangaroo courts to try people. And here it is some almost 7 years after, and not one person really has ever gone to trial in any of those cases. There was one guilty plea on a deal. David Hicks got 9 months because he wanted to get back home to Australia. But there still hasn't been one trial on any of these cases. And the government continues to receive blows on what is an unconstitutional and illegal international setup way of trying people. A couple of points on that, and then we'll move on to some other updates. But there was a so-called claimed driver for Bin Laden named Hamdan. Hamdan's case has been to the Supreme Court already once. In that case, they struck down the special military commissions, and they brought the trial up again in front of a military commission. And this time, they got another interesting order from the judges in the military commission saying that a man named Hartman, who was the military advisor to the prosecutor or the military commissions, had to be excluded from any part of the trial because he was putting undue pressure on the prosecutor, both as to use evidence, apparently from torture, as well as to prosecute cases that he thought were politically expedient or as one of the former military prosecutors said, were sexy cases. So Hamdan's case already now is in jeopardy again. And of course, compared to Hamdan, the others got even similar or more pressure from this guy named Hartman. So all those cases in front of the military commission are still up in the air. A second part of the military commission that happened recently is the center represents someone named Mohammed El-Khatani. he, some people have referred to, although there's no evidence at all, as the so-called 20th hijacker, although there's other people they referred to as that as well. Mohammed al-Qahtani was originally preliminarily charged, along with Khalik Sheikh Mohammed and some others, as being one of the conspirators, the main conspirators in the 9/11 conspiracy with regard to the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. He was facing the death penalty. The center was representing him. And all of a sudden, a couple of weeks ago, they came down with the so-called final charges, and Mohammed al-Qahtani was not among them. So for some reason, his case was dropped. We don't really know why it was dropped. His torture, though, was among the most public. He was the man who was, the log was released by Time magazine. Rumsfeld himself supervised the torture. He had liquids intravenously put into him while he was strapped to a chair and had a urinate in place. He was stripped naked, straddled by women, dogs, the whole gamut. Day by day, there's a log of it. So conceivably, they had nothing against Mohammed al-Qahtani except evidence of torture. So the military commissions are in a pretty bad way. And the third case before a military commission, of course, was Omar Khadr. Omar Khadr, if people remember, was the 15-year-old boy who was picked up in Afghanistan. He allegedly threw a grenade at U.S. soldiers when they attacked. He was the child of a supposedly known al-Qaeda leader who eventually was killed. But as a 15-year-old so-called child soldier, he should not have been taken to Guantanamo. He should not have been treated as an adult. It's a violation of all of the treaties protecting children to which the U.S. is a signatory. But despite that, they've kept him at Guantanamo, so he's now 21 years old. His lawyers made a motion in front of the military commissions that he should not be charged because he was a child soldier. They lost that motion. But at the same time, the Canadian courts started to consider the case, and the Canadian courts have now required that a number of documents be turned over to the United States on his case. And there's now even some question about whether he was the one who supposedly even threw the grenade. So I'm not clear that Omar Khadr's case is going to go forward either. So we're talking about military commissions that have more holes than a Swiss cheese. And I am pretty sure, as I have been for a long time, that there will never actually be a trial under the military commissions. And hopefully with a new president, I say hopefully only with a big push from lawyers and citizenry, that they'll never use this unconstitutional and illegal means for trying people. So that's the update on military commissions. As to Guantanamo itself, there's been a number of developments. One of them was the issuance by the Inspector General of the FBI of the FBI's role at Guantanamo. We've known some of that before. We know that we had Freedom of Information Act documents that came from the FBI that indicated the FBI was upset over a number of the so-called torture coercive tactics being used at Guantanamo and wanted to use the much more, I don't know what to say about them, but less coercive, or less overtly torture-type practices to interrogate people. What the FBI report said, and it's a long report, you can get it at various places on the web, is that the FBI did complain, the FBI agents there, and they actually opened a file. This was fascinating. The FBI agents at Guantanamo opened a file that they called the War Crimes File. And in that file, they put in their observations of what the military and the CIA was doing at Guantanamo. And when that report got up to the higher-ups at the FBI, they said, no, no, get rid of that file. We don't want you keeping a file called War Crimes File. That looks pretty bad here. And unfortunately, not to their credit, the uppers at the FBI really didn't do what they should have done when they got all of these reports. They didn't make major complaints. They didn't actually take it to the top. They didn't take it really into the National Security Council in the way they should have. And so the torture and coercion continued. But it did show that there was at least some resistance by the FBI. A second issue that came out with regard to Guantanamo was the Center for Constitutional Rights recently compiled a report that the extent to which countries all over the world cooperated with the United States in Guantanamo. And what they did is, and that goes from England to Spain to Canada, they sent their own intelligence people and interrogators down to Guantanamo when they knew the entire operation was a completely illegal setup. So this, while you see on one hand England saying, oh, no Guantanamo, or Canada, at the same time, sub rosa, underneath the table, they were cooperating with the United States in interrogating people. And the last update really on Guantanamo is that here we are in June, and we're waiting really with bated breath every day for the third Supreme Court opinion on the rights of people at Guantanamo and whether the Supreme Court, which we're waiting on a decision that was argued a number of months ago, will finally restore as a constitutional matter the writ of habeas corpus to people at Guantanamo. It's a big, big, important decision. In my view, if they restore the right, you will see the closing down of Guantanamo almost immediately because they have no evidence by which to hold people at all. Now, of course, everybody in the world is calling for the closing of Guantanamo. Everybody from the presidential candidates to Secretary of Defense Gates to Bush, but they all say, well, we're not getting cooperation from European countries or other countries, not just European, everywhere from Afghanistan to Yemen, who won't take their people back. Well, in my view, you know, there's no obligation. There should be an obligation to take their people back, but the obligation should really wind up at the feet of the United States, who illegally picked people up all over the world, took them away for 6 years, never proved a case against them, and now it should be the United States' job to shut the place down and bring those people into the United States if they can't actually send them home. But we'll see what happens in the next presidency. So a lot going on in Guantanamo. It's been a 7-year struggle. It's hard for me to believe. I remember as if I were sitting here the day it happened, the day the president issued the military order in November 13, 2001, and the day in December when the center got its first client, David Hicks, when no one we went to would touch Guantanamo with a 10-foot pole. So I feel good about it in many respects. We got 500 people out of there in various ways, but we're still sitting with really a what you could only call a hellhole on Guantanamo. So here we are with still 270 people at Guantanamo Bay.
We've covered the story on Law and Disorder of the kidnapping on a Milan street in 2003 of Muslim cleric Hassan Mustafa Osama Nasir, also known as Abu Omar. Well, 2 weeks ago in Milan, Abu Omar's wife spent over 6 hours on the stand, marking the first testimony in this case that opened nearly a year ago. It's focused on the United States' practice of extraordinary renditions and complicity with foreign governments in this kind of relocation. The testimony was graphic. Omar's wife said, "I found him wasted, skinny, so skinny his hair had turned white. He had a hearing aid." She also described how he was tied up like he was being crucified, was beaten, especially around his ears, and was subjected to electroshocks, including shocks to his genitals. Thus far, Italy has indicted 26 Americans, 25 of whom are CIA agents, and along with an Air Force colonel, in the disappearance of Abu Omar. They've cited a trail of incriminating cell phone exchanges intercepted by Italian prosecutors in the days before the cleric's disappearance. The U.S. government has said that it won't extradite the suspects in this case.
This is a really important case. A lot's going on in Europe with regard to prosecutions and the looking at what the CIA did in its extraordinary rendition program. In this case, Armando Spataro is the prosecutor in Italy, and they have a lot of independence because obviously now you have the Berlusconi government in Italy, which is very close to the United States, very right-wing, and is opposed to this prosecution and has tried to stop it. But so far, the Italian courts have refused to do it. And Armando Spataro is incredibly courageous proceeding with this. As an investigating judge, prosecutor in Italy, he did extraordinary amount of work over a year to get these 25 Americans indicted. So the case is really important. It's one that when you see what Spataro did with the cell phones alone, you realize what the potential is in Europe for really going after the CIA people.
I've also heard that Italian law enforcement agencies were upset at how this kidnapping took place because they said they could have arrested Abu Omar at any time, and they had him under surveillance, actually, for possible connections with terrorist organizations. They said that this, what they call clumsy and illegal kidnapping, really eradicated years of police work that they say they were on the verge of gaining valuable information about the working of terrorist organizations.
Yeah, that's right, Heidi. They said they were been watching him, and then without really telling the local police or the national police, I guess, the U.S. went and did this. Although I think that chief of intelligence actually knew about it and lost his job as a result of this kidnapping. And another nice touch was the chief of the CIA station there cannot go back to Italy, obviously. His name is known, and he actually, I think, he had a summer or some kind of house in Italy, and I think he got divorced and he lost his house because of this, et cetera, et cetera. So the case has already had reverberations within the agency. Hopefully other countries as well this will happen to. I know that in Germany, with the kidnapping of Al-Masri, that was the man who was kidnapped after he took a bus out of Germany, was kidnapped in, I think, Macedonia, sent to Afghanistan. He lost his case here in the U.S., but Germany did do indictments of some CIA agents, but have so far refused to ask for the extradition from the United States of those agents. So Europe is a fairly hot place for the agency right now. And I think that Armando Spataro, the Italian prosecutor, has really been courageous on this case. A remarkable, star-studded, radical new film on U.S. war profiteering in Iraq debuted last week. The movie is called War, Inc., written by John Cusack and Jeremy Pixar. War, Inc. is described as bringing to the screen what Naomi Klein has done in print. In Jeremy Scahill's review, he writes, quote, "With 630 corporations like Blackwater and Halliburton on the U.S. government payroll in Iraq, getting 40% of the more than $2 billion Washington spends every week on the occupation, Cusack's futuristic film is not far from the way things really are. The film stars John Cusack as Brand Hauser, a hitman for hire who is deployed to Tarakistan to kill a Middle Eastern oil baron. We're joined by co-writer of the film War, Inc., Jeremy Pixar. He's also the co-writer of Bulworth and Lemon Sisters, and just finished a screenplay about the CIA coup that overthrew the government of Guatemala in 1954.
Jeremy, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Jeremy, it's just wonderful to have you. I loved your films for years. Your last big film was what?
Bulworth.
I actually went out and I bought Bulworth so I can see it over and over again. It's my absolute favorite political film. And now you've come out with War Incorporated.
Well, I call it War Incorporated.
Oh, you do?
And it was the marketing people's title anyway, so I don't know what it's really supposed to be called.
Well, on the trailer it says, when it comes to war, America means business.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the movie.
Well, it started out with John Cusack getting me and a guy named Mark Lehner, who's sort of a novelist mostly, together to work on a script for a film. He wanted to play a hitman working in the Middle East, and he wanted to sort of take a shot at U.S. policies in the Middle East. And that's sort of all he really had to start with. And we started talking about what we thought was going on in the Middle East, and we sort of threw this idea together where he is a guy who he's a hitman who's working for an international conglomerate headed by a former vice president. That's a lot like, I guess you would say, Halliburton. We call it Tamerlane. It's set somewhat in the future, and it's about how this company has been hired by the U.S. government to, quote-unquote, liberate a country called Tarakistan, and they need him to take out a rival oil head executive of a competing company that wants to run an oil pipeline through Tarakistan. And in the process of doing that, he's a producer of a trade show, because the idea of this company, their motto, which actually hasn't made it into the final cut of the film, is "We blow them up, we fix them up." That is, they are hired by the U.S. government to destroy a country, and then they go in and sell that country all the things it needs to rebuild itself into an American-style commercial, quote-unquote, democracy.
It's part of the history of U.S. capitalism since World War II.
Well, that's exactly it.
Now, Jeremy, you and John Cusack wrote the film, correct?
And Mark Lehner.
Tell us, is it a drama? Is it a comedy? What kind of political points you're trying to make?
I mean, we actually try to... one of the quotes that I like best is genre-bending. But yeah, essentially it's a satire, it's a comedy. I think what we're trying to do is kind of depict what we feel is going on with U.S. foreign policy in the only form that seems right to me, because it's so maddeningly insane. When you have a debate where the opposition party in the United States is saying the problem is we're not making, the Iraqis aren't doing enough of a job in holding up their end of our occupation of their country. You can't take this discussion seriously because it's so completely out of whack with reality. And so we're trying to make it that war is essentially a commercial enterprise, and we just try and satirize all aspects of that, as well as, you know, the way journalism has covered it, how everything has been corporatized. And, you know, for instance, we have what we call implanted journalists. We don't have embedded journalists. We have implanted journalists. They have a little chip put in the back of their brain.
It's funny.
And then they go into an IMAX theater and see the war in a completely casualty-free environment. And it says outside, and it's sort of like a ride inside this trade show, and it says Vanilla Coke presents the implanted journalist experience. And they go in and they watch the war, and they see soldiers receiving flowers from the population, and they give candy to the children, and they see all this on the screen, and that's their reality.
Yeah. Jeremy, I tell you, I saw the trailer. I haven't seen the film yet, and just to hear your description. But tell me, when did it open, and what have the reviews been like, political, not political?
It opened in New York at the Angelica. Well, first, it premiered at the Tribeca Festival. There were four shows at the Tribeca. They were all sold out. They had to add a fifth show, which ultimately got sold out. So that was kind of nice. It opened commercially at the Angelica on the 23rd, just this past Friday, and at the Landmark in Los Angeles. And we did very well for the first weekend. We were not able to get this made by, you know, a mainline Hollywood company. Nobody really wanted to touch it. We found sort of this kind of weird Israeli outfit.
No, really? That's weird.
That makes, well, because the thing is they make Steven Seagal movies and things like that, as long as it's under the budget, and they think they can pre-sell it around the world. They basically said, you know, you'll put in a couple more explosions, you'll do it for under $10 million, we'll do it. and that was
funny.
Kind of the deal, you know. And we had to make it in Bulgaria, where they bought up the Bulgarian film industry after the fall of the Soviet Union. And that's how we got it made. And so it was done under, you know, kind of very severe circumstances. We didn't have the budget. We had about a quarter of the budget we needed. And we had to use, some of the actors we used didn't speak any English. They were using transliterations, you know, just doing their parts phonetically. Because we couldn't bring any actors over to Bulgaria. So we could only use English-speaking people who were already in Bulgaria.
Amazing. Mm-hmm.
Except for the main cast. And we have a wonderful main cast.
Wonderful. Who's in it?
Marissa Tomei, Sir Ben Kingsley, Hilary Duff, playing the Britney Spears of Central Asia, and really kind of redefining her public image. She plays a character named Yannicka Babia, who is this sort of 15-year-old slut, which, if you know anything about Hilary Duff, which likely your listeners don't, she's always been this sort of Disney, squeaky clean girl next door, virginal, and she plays sort of the opposite thing. Marissa Tomei plays a left-wing journalist who sort of captures the hitman's heart and makes him sort of face the reality of what he's about. She calls her a pimped out monster of alienated Western sexuality is how she describes this girl, and I think that's sort of what she is. And she gets saved in the end too, as it turns out. We have sort of a happy ending, but then not, as what would, you know, would be appropriate for this.
Now, how does this all relate to Blackwater, Iraq, liability for private corporations?
Well, you know, the funny thing is, it really turned into something that's very much about privatization. When we started, it was, you know, and that's why we started thinking that the real target was more Halliburton, and sort of the confluence of the U.S. government and private industry. You know, I think in this particular Bush regime, more strikingly than probably in any previous regime, although, you know, it's something more of degree than kind, I think. The U.S. government policy is just an expression of corporate interest.
The executive committee of the ruling class.
Exactly. And so that's, you know, that's where we were starting from. We wanted, that was how we saw it. And, you know, and I think there was actually a slight failure of nerve a little bit, because we started writing this in 2003.
Wow.
You know, and there was such reverence for this war generally in the country at that time that we thought we could make a joke and sort of cover our asses a little bit by saying that these soldiers that were doing these horrible things were actually not U.S. soldiers but private contractors. I don't think that was the main impetus, but because it seemed like it was a good point to make anyway. We didn't actually know about what Blackwater was doing when we started this. All of this stuff, we have learned so much stuff that we anticipated in this script that we didn't really know was going on. We didn't do a tremendous amount of research. We thought the situation was so outrageous and such, you know, such a lie from the beginning, from before the beginning, that just what was lying around on the ground, what we saw, you know, just from surfing the internet for a few hours every day, just kind of being aware and having a certain perspective about what was going on. It was so obvious. It was so bald-faced that we didn't really feel we had to do that much research in order to present a radically different view than the one we were getting and people were believing.
Well, we're grateful for your doing it. Jeremy Scahill reviewed it for The Nation. He did a little research. He says there's 630 corporations over in Iraq. They're making 40% of the $2 billion a week that the United States government spends over there. And it truly is a commercial enterprise. And thanks to you, Jeremy. This has come out. The movie's at the...
Well, thanks to Jeremy Scahill. Come on.
Well, thanks to you for making...
And Naomi Klein and all these wonderful people that inspired us enormously in the process of doing this, and we were so glad to get Jeremy's positive review.
Tell us again where it's playing and where people can go.
It's playing... Right now, it's playing at the Angelica in New York, the Landmark in L.A. On June 13th, we're going to expand to four more cities because... People have been filling the theaters in New York and L.A., I think much to everybody's surprise.
What cities are you going to expand to?
It's not entirely definite. Mm-hmm. I think San Francisco for sure, and Chicago for sure, and maybe Boston, maybe Austin, maybe Seattle.
Madison?
Not yet.
Anyway,
it's our recommendation. This film just sounds wonderful. We'll go tonight.
We're going to be there with the popcorn and the Coke.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you,
Jeremy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. We as the young wish to say in this song, God bless great America. We give thanks to the old for achieving their goal. It is now up to us, and we know we must build up a trust. And we want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. Power for the people. Power for the people. Power for the people. Power for the people. Hardening crimes is a part of the times, and it's rough for some people to live. Disease can move fast, but it don't have to last. It is now the nation's turn for all to be concerned. We can be freer still. It is the people's will, and bring back the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. Power for the people. Power for the people. Power for the people. Power for the people.
Professor Richard Falk is the recently appointed Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories for the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, who has been barred entry into Israel. Richard Falk is a professor of international law at Princeton. He was asked to be the consul's special investigator on Israel's behavior in the occupied territories. This incited furious objections from Yitzhak Levanon, the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva. Falk replaced South African John Duggard, a veteran anti-apartheid activist. Falk is also a member of the editorial boards of The Nation magazine and The Progressive magazine. He's the author of many books, including Crimes of War, Iraq.
Professor Richard Falk, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our listeners should know that you were recently appointed Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Palestine Territories for the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. You were then barred entry. And I know that this is a concern, the alleged violations of human rights by Israel has been a concern of yours for many years. Before you were barred entry, you had been to Israel, hadn't you?
Yes, I've been quite a number of times, both to Israel and to the West Bank and Gaza.
What kind of concerns were raised when you had first gone there?
Well, Israel has previously objected to my participation in any kind of formal UN-backed undertaking on the grounds that I had, through my writing and so on, indicated an attitude that was critical of their occupation policies. Critical from the perspective of international humanitarian law and human rights, and that therefore I was not impartial. For that reason, I was not a suitable person to be undertaking this kind of observation. And my response to that has consistently been, including in this recent situation, that I am impartial in the sense that my commitment, professional commitment, is to tell the truth as best I can, and that to do it in a way that is not concerned with the political correctness of what that truth may be. And I think that's what the UN is entitled to expect, and that's what I would certainly try to do to the extent that I'm able to discharge this new mandate that I've been given.
You know, they accused C. Wright Mills of similar bias, and his response was, "I'm objective, if not detached." And I would say the same thing for you. It's remarkable that Israel thinks it can hold the power to choose whoever it wants to investigate them.
Well, in fact, see, in my view, Israel is much happier to have someone like me that they can attack in this way, because anyone with a 20% open mind would come to the same conclusions if they were exposed to the kind of policies that Israel has been implementing in the occupation.
What kind of conclusions, Richard, would you, I mean, I know you want to conclude your report, but what kind of things are you really addressing?
I'm not foreclosing changing my mind if I'm allowed to examine the facts and to consider Israel's arguments and so on about security and how they bear upon their occupation policy. But on the basis of what I had observed in the past, it seemed to me that the underlying wrongdoing associated with the occupation was to rely on collective punishment as a way of breaking the political will of the Palestinians to have any kind of movement for their own self-determination.
And that's a violation of international humanitarian law?
Yeah, it's a fundamental violation of both international humanitarian law and international criminal law. I mean, it was part of the Nuremberg rationale for punishing Germans and later Japanese for, in effect, imposing harsh treatment on those who are essentially innocent of any wrongdoing.
Richard, when you talk about collective punishment, what kind of things are we talking about?
Well, most recently, the aspects of collective punishment that are most salient is to impose a siege on an entire territory that has its impact on women, children, old people, disabled people, whoever, and threatens their livelihood and health and imposes on their daily existence a kind of persisting traumatic ordeal. And it was that judgment that we reached back in 2001 when examining the conditions in Gaza that seemed much less severe than what has emerged more recently, particularly since the 2006 elections that were won by Hamas. And one way of understanding the Israeli occupation policies since then is as a retaliation directed at the Palestinian people because they voted for this kind of political leadership.
I wanted to ask if you could explain a bit about the mandate of the Special Rapporteur and the history of how effective it's been.
Yes, that's an important issue. The mandate is essentially to explore the consistency with which Israel as the occupying power in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem has fulfilled its role legally as occupier of the territory, which that means it covers the period since 1967 when the occupation occurred. And incidentally, it's the longest occupation in modern times. It is governed by the Fourth Geneva Convention, which tries to specify in some detail the obligations of an occupying power. And the two things that I think are central to the understanding of the thinking that underlay this Geneva Convention were that the conditions in an occupied territory should be maintained in the way that the occupier found them. In other words, there should be no effort to transform the territory in a way that is beneficial to the occupier. And this relates very directly to the establishment of the settlements throughout the West Bank particularly, and to some extent in Jerusalem. And the other thing is to do everything possible to respect the well-being and innocence of the civilian population that is under occupation. It's those two broad goals, I think, that the international humanitarian law is most eager to protect. And there are a lot of more detailed obligations that are spelled out in the course of the Geneva Conventions.
Richard, I was in Israel and the occupied territories in 1985, just before the first Palestinian uprising, and then came back and testified to the Human Rights Committee at the United Nations on what we saw. And what was shocking to us when we went over there, it was a National Lawyers Guild delegation, and we were able to have access to the territories, was that the Israelis were deporting Palestinian leaders, not necessarily political people, artists, dentists, a journalist, anybody that could give some leadership to the Palestinian people. We went and requested and were granted a meeting with the American ambassador to Israel. We asked him what his position was on those deportations, which were violations of the Fourth Geneva Convention, and he said, "I agree with you." So we then went and had a press conference and allied with the American ambassador and said this was illegal.
Yeah.
And then we came back and testified at the United Nations. Didn't get very much publicity over here. We got much more over in Israel. But the Israelis at the time were saying, well, it's a liberal occupation. Of course, there's no such thing as a liberal occupation. But at least the United States was giving lip service to being critical of it at that point. Is anybody in the United States government standing up for the right of the United Nations to have you as their representative go to Israel with an objective mind to report on what you see?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, I don't know what has transpired in some kind of more quiet diplomatic context, but as near as I can tell, there has been no effort to persuade Israel to change its policy. The policy, incidentally, of barring my entry was disclosed by a formal press release by the Israeli Foreign Ministry, in which they indicated that they would, in fact, bar my entry. And if I tried to come just as an ordinary tourist and undertook to do anything connected with this, with my role as special rapporteur, they would then take what they called, quote-unquote, drastic measures. You probably are familiar with the fact that they've just barred Norman Finkelstein.
You know, I was just going to ask you about that. He can't go back for 10 years.
And he has not, I mean, of course, he's written high-profile books that are highly critical of Israel, but he's basically a person that hasn't engaged, as far as I know, in any political action. They accused him, apparently, of having some sort of contact with Hezbollah leaders, but and therefore they invoked some kind of security argument, but it seems like a pretty transparently misleading contention. Incidentally, he was my student at Princeton.
Was he really? That's very funny. I didn't know that. Let me ask you, what's going to happen next? I mean, now you have this Israeli press release saying, Richard Falk, don't come over here. You have a UN appointment, I presume, through the High Commissioner of Human Rights.
Well, the appointment is actually from the UN Human Rights Council.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
The 47 countries that are members, right. And it had to be unanimous.
Wow.
And there were a lot of other candidates, so it was something. And Israel and the U.S. spoke against me. They're not members of the council, or otherwise I obviously wouldn't have
been unanimous.
It wouldn't have been unanimous, and therefore the appointment wouldn't have been made. They only make the appointments if they are. And the only, of the 47 countries, the only government that spoke against me was Canada, but they didn't vote against me.
Isn't that interesting about Canada? Because the High Commissioner for Human Rights, of course, she's leaving in June, right?
Yes.
Louise Arbour. I can't imagine that she would have spoken against you, so it's fascinating.
Oh, she, in fact, has written me a very lovely congratulatory letter. So.
And she's Canadian, of course, was a Supreme Court justice in Canada, and it's interesting that then Canada actually spoke against you. Fascinating.
Well, of course, their government now is pretty closely aligned with the U.S. government.
Right. So what happens next, Richard, on this?
Well, it remains to be seen. I'm still hopeful that I can persuade the Israelis to allow me to come in. If that does, I'm going to Geneva for 2 weeks to work on this issue. And if they don't, we'll see what the best adjustment is, either to have people go on my behalf to the occupied territories or try to arrange to meet people outside of Israel and interview them there. I really don't know what is practical and what sort of approach under these circumstances will operate best. I've been invited to a conference in Jerusalem, quite independent of this role, and that would be one way of testing whether they do indeed intend to bar my entry.
I just want to remind our listeners that we're speaking with Professor Richard Falk, who's one of the great international lawyers and human rights lawyers in the country. We were also pleased to see that he was appointed by the United Nations to go over on a fact-finding mission to Israel, and then equally disappointed to see that the Israelis evidently have something to hide because they won't let him into the country.
Richard, you mentioned some of your prior writings, and I'm interested in telling our listeners where they can find them, on Israel in particular, the occupied territories, and how they get them.
Well, Michael, I've written several things over the years. the thing that actually agitated the Israelis, or at least they relied upon in justifying their criticism of me in the debate at Geneva, was a piece on the occupation of Gaza that was really a journalistic piece that was written about 9 months ago, when I was very disturbed about what I felt to be a unfolding humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza that threatened really the actual survival of the Gazan people as a whole. And I wrote this very strong piece that was originally published by the leading Turkish newspaper and then picked up on the internet and spread around quite a bit. And because it emphasized the wrongfulness and criminality of collective punishment of this kind, I invoked a comparison with what Nazi Germany had done to the Jews as a way of really trying to say, and it was directed partly at the American reality, that we were complicit in a policy that seemed to me to be of a criminal nature. And it was that article in particular. I had written earlier things that were more academic on the international law aspects of the occupation.
What was the name of the piece that you wrote 9 months ago?
I think the title that was given to it was something like Slouching Toward a Holocaust in Gaza.
Wow.
That's a nice title.
Yeah. Richard, I can see why it was a bit provocative.
Yes, well, it was intended to be. Because I felt there was such complacency, given the severity of what was happening there, that it was an attempt to raise the threshold of awareness. Of course, I wouldn't have written this kind of piece if I had known I was going to have this role. I wouldn't have used that language at any rate. Yeah. Maybe it was ill-considered.
I don't know that, but you always make me, it always makes me very proud to even be able to talk to you, Richard, I have to say. You're a special person. You know, since my earliest days when I didn't really know you, but when you knew the Center for Constitutional Rights through Peter Weiss and the war in Vietnam, et cetera, it's been an amazingly consistent, very, very progressive career. So it really makes me proud to even know you, Richard.
Those words coming from you mean a lot to me. I'm a great admirer of what the center has been doing.
Well, thank you.
Well, Professor Richard Falk, keep up the good work. And thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and you too keep up the good work.
We'll hope to see you someday in the occupied territories, Richard.
Good, mate. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
That's lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Talk about the ghetto right on from here. Yeah.